a wintry evening, having a Rachel in the office who's a Buckeye. She's always quick to shame us, you know, and say, no, tell us what it's like in Ohio and how they wouldn't dare cancel for a couple inches of snow or whatever. But we'll get our work done. I want to begin tonight to speak to you on the subject of the Lord's Prayer. And it's found in Matthew chapter 5 through 7. And things can change, but I think that what would be profitable to me to study and perhaps profitable for us to discuss is to work our way through the Lord's Prayer on Sunday nights of this year. And again, that could change. There would be some Sunday nights where perhaps we wouldn't be focused on this passage. But from what I can gather, there's at least the way I'm looking at it, probably 30 to 40 sermons here or lessons. And so I'd like to walk through the Lord's, the Sermon on the Mount in our Sunday nights together for this year. Now, what's the Sermon on the Mount? And essentially, it's the most complete sermon that we have preserved that comes from Jesus. It's this really magnum opus. It's essentially a combination of all of his teachings, and it brings all of the threads of his teaching together. It's a passage, and we have parts of that sermon found in Luke on the Sermon on the Plain, but I think that this is a passage that is worthy of our study. Now, what's the thesis of the Sermon on the Mount? I mean, if we were to try to bring it together, because there's a lot in here. You know, you look through it, and you have the Beatitudes, and you have the model prayer, and you come to the end, and he talks about building on the rock, and so it seems like you've got a lot of different things coming into the Sermon on the Mount. What's the thesis? I mean, how do you begin to get hold of this passage? What is Jesus driving at, or is he almost speaking as a proverbial speaker where he's throwing out a lot of different things on a lot of different topics that don't necessarily have any general theme? Well, most of the people who look at this passage the scholars in particular would say that the thesis verse is Matthew chapter 5 verse 20, where Jesus says this, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter into the kingdom of heaven." The ideal, the thread, the nucleus of the sermon is, what does it mean to be righteous? It seems to me that that's what Jesus is trying to answer. That's the fundamental question as we look through these three chapters together in the coming weeks and months. Now, it's interesting then that Jesus would deliver this sermon, and essentially he's asking the question and trying to answer the question, what does righteousness look like? I mean, a righteous person, a holy person, somebody who's living as they should. What exactly does that look like? It's interesting that he would address that subject to a religious crowd, because that's who he's talking to. In fact, in Matthew chapter 5, later on, there's seven, "You have heard it said." And so he works through what they have heard, and he's assuming that they have heard things. He's assuming that they are synagogue goers, because, again, where would you hear it? Well, you would hear it from the scholars in the synagogues. And he works through seven sayings regarding, and by the way, that they aren't huge subjects, because he talks about oaths and adultery and divorce, going the second mile. And so these are things that, I mean, if you'd gone to church once in your life, you probably wouldn't have heard many sermons on oaths. But these are people, and he's assuming you have heard. You understand what the law says on a variety of subjects. So I'm going to tell you what I say on those subjects. So he's talking about righteousness to religious people. The question is why? Why spend this magnum opus talking to religious people about what righteousness ought to look like? I think that the answer is because righteousness is more likely to get distorted in religious settings than non-religious settings. Listen, if you grow up in church, as I did and probably many of you did, there's only really three things that can happen. First thing that can happen is that you just reject it altogether. You get to a certain age and you say, I don't want to go to church. I'm not going to go to church. I don't believe what I've been taught in church. And there's just a massive rejection. You just walk away from the whole thing. Second thing that can happen is you adopt the faith of your parents, but it becomes your own faith. In other words, as you're going to church, as you're interacting in a religious community, maybe you start with the faith of your parents, but you come to find something of your own. That there is a genuine faith, a genuinely personal faith that you find in the midst of that. And so you develop a personal relationship with God through that. And so you reject it or you find something that is very personal to you that you'll keep the rest of your life. But the third thing can happen if you grow up in a church, and that is that you miss the essential point. You miss the relationship. You miss what righteousness really looks like. But you sort of form your own religion, and it's going to have some thou shalts and thou shalt nots, but you essentially develop a religion or a sense of righteousness or a sense of what holiness or morality looks like without any substance to it personally. And that happens for millions and millions and millions of people. And the people who do that are the ones who end up having crazy ideals, because essentially any theology or any doctrine of right and wrong or ethics that we develop in the end under scrutiny looks pretty silly. And you and I can compare people that we've met through our own lives, and it becomes pretty obvious that they missed the point of Christianity. They missed the point of Jesus' teaching, but they have their own set of right and wrongs. They formed their own religion inside of the Christian community. I knew a woman once who, one of the great thou shalt nots in her life that she came to establish was thou shalt not serve in any church position if thou hast been divorced. And man, she was hard on divorce, harder on remarriage. But she had a daughter that she loved dearly, and that daughter was a part-time attender. That daughter probably over a 10-year period, at some point or another, lived with 10 different men. She lived with them about 6 months. She'd come to church, have an emotional experience, get saved. And man, she was in the choir. You know, she was trying to help any way she could. Now, the mother was, you know, the mother didn't want the church doing anything to discourage her. If she wanted to lead the choir, that would have been okay with the mother. What was not okay is if you had been divorced once. You can live with as many men as you want as long as you don't marry them. If you don't marry them, you can come and you can do anything that you want. But if you marry them and you divorce, you're out. That's a very strange doctrine. I knew a woman who, one of her chief concerns in life, and she thought about it a lot because she talked about it a lot, was how you ought to dress when you come to church. It was very, very important to her. And she put a lot of time, hundreds of hours of her life, apparently, in how somebody ought to dress when they come to church. And she's very strict, and I was her pastor, and violators were reported frequently. And as a pastor, you preach and you run the complaint department Monday through Friday. And so she was at the complaint department quite frequently. And but she had granddaughters who, if you listen to her talk, never committed a sin. I mean, those girls were angels to her. And throughout the summer, they were all through the community wearing those shorts that don't have any leg on them, you know. Beach, man, they're down there in the smallest bikini you can find. But they didn't do it at church. That was the difference. They had enough respect to wear a knee-length dress to church, although they dressed like the devil outside of church. But that was important to her. What mattered is how you dressed at church, not how you dress outside of church. It's not important to her. It's a crazy doctrine. One of the discussions that you would have in a lot of churches is, you know, really, if you want to be in good standing in the church, what do you have to show up to? And you get all kinds of different opinions. You know, if you really love the Lord, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Sunday school, Wednesday night, and others will say, no, listen, if you really love the Lord, you'll show up to work days. And we talked about that. I mean, if you really love the Lord, there's an apron waiting for you in the kitchen. You'll work. The essence is work. And those two can be very critical of each other. You have another group who may say, hey, listen, if you love the Lord, you'll be witnessing. Don't tell me you love the Lord if you haven't ever led somebody to Christ. Don't tell me you love the Lord if you haven't led somebody to Christ in the last 2 or 3 years. How can you say you love the Lord? I mean, come on. The essence of Christianity is to live an evangelistic lifestyle. It's not filling a pew. It's not being back there, you know, working. I mean, that can turn into a club in and of itself. You work because those are your friends, and that's. Those are conversations regarding what righteousness looks like. What is righteous? When God is looking down on us, how do you know if He's seeing you as righteous or holy? And again, when you grow up in the church, you can have crazy ideals, and like I said, you know, righteousness is that you've never been divorced, you do this, you do that, or righteousness has a lot to do with how you address when you come to church, or righteousness has a lot to do with when and how and you show up. But the question is that God's ideal of righteousness? And so I think it makes sense that when Jesus gets all the religious people together, he says, I want to talk to you about what righteousness looks like. Because y'all have different ideals, and one's over here, and you're over there, and you got a lot of crazy ideals, and you got a lot of conflicting ideals. But I want to have a long, solid discussion with you about what I see righteousness looking like. And so he begins. Says in verse 1 of chapter 5 that he sat down. Everyone's standing. I just point that out because a lot of people want to return to the days of Jesus. And I just point out that the speaker sat and everybody else stood for the sermon. It was a sign of respect. It's one thing you don't want to return to, right? But Jesus sits down and they're standing. And he begins to talk about righteousness. And verse 1, it says, and seeing the multitudes, he went on a mountain. And when he was seated, his disciples came to him, and then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed. What does it mean to be blessed? Why would God talk about what righteousness looks like, and he begins with the blessed passage or the Beatitudes? There was a secular meaning for the word blessed, and there was a scriptural, or there was a Old Testament meaning of the word blessed. The secular meaning of the word blessed meant self-contained, and some translations translate it as happy, but the Greek word was a word called makaros, and what it meant essentially was that you had everything that you needed, and you were longing for nothing. That was the essence of this word. In the secular sense. In fact, the island of Cyprus was called the Makaros Island. And the idea was that people believed on Cyprus, you had everything that you needed. All the fruit, all the trees, all the animals. There was nothing that you would lack if you lived on Cyprus. There was never a reason to leave the island. It was a self-contained, a completely self-contained island. And it was called the Makaros Island, or the Happy Island. If you were there, you could be content because you lacked nothing. And so, in at least the secular sense, to be blessed meant that you lacked nothing. You had everything that you needed to live a fruitful life. But in the Old Testament, blessed meant approved of God. It meant that God was pleased with you, that God was happy with you. And to some degree, I think that those two things intertwine, because if God approves of you and God is happy with you and you are blessed of God, If God has given you himself, then technically you have everything you need. You ought to be self-contained, theologically. And so he says, blessed, contented, self-contained, approved of God, are the poor in spirit. The first sign of righteousness, the first attribute of somebody who is blessed, the first sign of somebody who's approved of God is that they are a poor in spirit person. That's what righteousness looks like. You're looking for a righteous person, first trait is that they are a poor in spirit person. Now, notice, it's poverty, but it's a certain kind of poverty. He's not saying blessed are the poor in finances, or blessed are the poor in stocks and bonds, or blessed are the poor in poor in attitude. Blessed are the poor mouths. Blessed are those who are poor and that they have nothing good to say. That's not what he's driving at. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Now, what's he driving at when he says poor here? And then what's he driving at when he says spirit? There are two words in the Greek language for poor. One word meant that you live paycheck to paycheck. And that is that you lived and those folks would be paid daily. They would earn their wage every day. They would get that wage. They would go out. They would buy food. And they would have food for tomorrow. And they were paycheck to paycheck people. They were poor. My father, when he went to Bible college in Texas, he went down with three kids and ended up having a fourth while he was down there. And he was 25 maybe when he went down. And he was poor. Paycheck to paycheck. We were talking a few weeks ago, and we were just, he was reminiscing. I wasn't reminiscing. I wasn't thought of in Texas. I came later in Pennsylvania. But he said one Friday, he was working as a carpenter. The boss came around and said, hey, your checks didn't come in, and we'll get everybody paid on Monday. And he said, I went to him and was pleading because there literally wasn't any milk or bread in the house. My mom had told him, buy groceries on your way home because we don't have any groceries. And he said, I went and begged and pleaded and said, we got nothing. We got three kids and there's no milk in the house. And they paid me out of petty cash. And they held me over till Monday. But he was poor, paycheck to paycheck. But and that was one use of the word. But there was another word for poor in the Greek language, and it meant destitute. I mean, those weren't the people living paycheck to paycheck. Those weren't the people living day by day. Those were people that had nothing. Those weren't the employed. Those were the unemployed. Those were the people without houses. Those were the people with literally nothing but the clothes on their back. Those were the homeless people. And that's the word that Jesus is using here. He says, blessed are the spiritually destitute. Blessed are the spiritually homeless. Blessed are those who spiritually would say, I have absolutely nothing. And they stand before God. And that's what I think he's driving at when he talks about being poor in spirit. It's seeing that you're standing before God. It's there and you're looking at God and you're saying, I have absolutely nothing to offer him. I have absolutely, positively nothing to give him. I have absolutely nothing apart from God that I can do to help myself. And that's the first step of a 12-step program, right? Celebrate recovery. Step one, I admit that I am not God and I am powerless to control my urges to do wrong. That's it. I admit that I'm not God, and I am powerless to help myself. If God doesn't help me, I'm hopeless. See, you're not poor in spirit yet if you're saying, you know what, I need to get in church because that's the right thing to do. No, that's not poor in spirit yet. You're not poor in spirit when you say, you know what, there's some things I do right, but there's a lot of things I do wrong, and I need to start doing some of this stuff right. See, that's not poor in spirit. You're not poor in spirit if you're saying, you know, I need to turn a chapter in my life. You're not poor in spirit if you're saying, you know what, I need to pull myself up and I need to make something of myself. You're not poor in spirit yet. You're not poor in spirit till you say, I have absolutely nothing and I am entirely helpless apart from God. That's what poor in spirit means. You reach the point. You've almost, it's ironic because you almost have to be completely hopeless to get hope. Isn't that ironic? When you are completely hopeless in and of yourself, when you look at yourself and say, I can't do anything to really fix myself apart from God. I am completely broke standing in front of Him. When you reach that point of hopelessness, and you know what? There's a truckload of hope. But there's no hope till you recognize in and of yourself you're hopeless. And that's what it means to be poor in spirit. He said, blessed, approved of God, righteous are the poor in spirit. And then secondly, he says, righteous, blessed, approved of God are those who mourn. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Again, I don't think that this is any kind of mourning, because crying in and of itself isn't a virtue. It's not. I mean, people mourn over a lot of different things. People mourn over football games. People mourn over any number of sports. People mourn, when relationships that have only been going on for a couple days break up. People mourn over finances. People mourn over a lot of different things. I remember sitting with a woman once, and she had come to see me, and there's so much irony in that conversation because she was a married woman having an affair with a married man, and he had come to his senses and broke that relationship off and gone back to his wife and begged and pleaded that she would forgive him, and his family was restored, but she was mourning the loss of her lover. You can mourn the loss of your adulterous relationship. I mean, you can mourn a lot of different things in life, but I think that there's a connection here. I think mourning has to follow the poor in spirit. I think these two are together for a reason. And so I think what is being said here by Jesus is, blessed are those who mourn or grieve or are touched by their poverty in spirit. Blessed are those who see that they have nothing in and of themselves to save themselves. Blessed are those who know that they stand before God completely hopeless, completely broke, destitute of anything to offer Him, and they grieve it. It touches them, and it moves them. See, I think the mourning here is what you see in the Bible. You know, when Isaiah chapter 6, verse 5, and he's righteous, but he goes to the temple and he sees the glory of God in the temple. The glory of God fills the place, a train of his robes. We're in the temple. And what does he say? He says, woe is me. I'm a man of unclean lips. And I dwell among a people of unclean lips. What's he doing? He's grieving his poverty. He's looking at God and he's comparing himself to God, and he is poor in spirit and he is grieving his poverty of spirit. That's what Job did in Job 42:6, right? After he's gone through everything and he's questioned God, and God shows up and Job says something to the degree of, he said, I had heard with my ears, but now I see with my eyes. Remember that passage? I've heard with my ears. Now I see with my eyes, and I abhor myself and repent in sackcloth and ashes. What's Job saying? He said, oh man, I'm in trouble. I thought I was a righteous guy. I thought I had something to offer God, but I am poor in spirit and I grieve it. I abhor myself. Remember Peter in Luke 5:18, I believe, when Jesus is there and Peter meets him and he says, depart from me, I'm a sinful man. Get away, I'm poor in spirit. You shouldn't be around me. I have nothing to offer you. There's nothing in me that you would want. Depart from me, I'm a sinful person. Remember Paul in Romans 7:24, when he says, what does he say? Something like Peter said, I forget now. It's a woe is me passage. And Paul, you have to look it up in Romans 7:24. But Paul is essentially saying, I'm completely destitute. There's nothing. And it grieves my heart that it's like this. And I think that that's the kind of grieving that Jesus is talking about. He says, if you're poor in spirit, if you recognize you have nothing to offer God, and it moves you to grief, if it touches you, if you are burdened by that, you shall be comforted. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. I mean, that only makes sense, doesn't it? I remember reading about, I believe his name was Paderewski, who was a great Polish pianist, and he was mentoring this young girl, and she got up and she did her recital, and she butchered it. And she was in tears on the piano bench. I mean, absolutely embarrassed herself. And he went over and he sat down next to her and he put her arms around her and comforted her. I mean, that's what you do, right? If somebody is poor in spirit and they're grieving it, you don't kick them. I mean, if you're a teacher, and many of you, some of you are teachers, if there's a student and they blow the exam and they come to you and they say, "That was horrible, and I'm so embarrassed, and I shouldn't even be in this class. You ought to throw me out of this class. I'm a terrible student. I'm an awful student. I don't even deserve to be in this school." And they're touched by it. You don't look at them and say, "You're right. Get out." No, you say, "Wow, come on in. I'm going to help you. I'm going to get you through this. I'm going to give you some more time. I'm going to tutor you. I'm going to get you through this." Because, I mean, who can resist somebody who's poor in spirit and they're grieving it? I mean, if you're a coach, you got a player, and he did make the dumbest mistake on the field you've ever seen as a coach. That was ridiculous. Going to the locker room at halftime, and there he is with his towel over his head saying, "Coach, I'm the worst player in the history of the game. I don't deserve to be on this team. I'm not going out there. It's too embarrassing." What would you do as a coach? You go over there and you embrace them. And you encourage them to get up and keep going. And the Bible says that's what God does. If you recognize you're broke before Him, if you recognize you have nothing to offer Him, and if it grieves you and touches you, you shall be comforted by God. It's just the way that He is. Finally, and I'll move hurriedly here. He said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Again, I think there's a sequence. If you're poor in spirit and you're mourning your poverty of spirit, the natural result is that it makes you a meek person. If you have the first two, you're going to have the third. What does meekness mean? Meekness is not weakness. Meekness is strength under control. The word meek referred to a horse that was being restrained by the bridle. It was an animal that was under control. There's a letter by a Peloponnesian soldier, and he was in battle, and this is many, many years, even before Jesus lived. He was in battle. He captured a beautiful white stallion, and he wanted to bring it home to his wife, and he wrote a letter to her, and that letter is preserved somewhere. But he wrote a letter to her, and he's saying, "It's one of the most powerful horses, and this is an amazing horse." He handles to the tightest sensitivity of the bridle, and then he finished, and he said, "He's a meek horse." What does he mean? It was strength under control. It didn't mean he was a weak horse. Didn't mean he was a broken down horse. It meant that he was a strong horse, but he was under the control of the bridle. Meekness is really gentleness. That's what we're talking about. Meekness is gentleness. I mean, listen, Bible says in Numbers chapter 12, verse 3, it says that Moses was the meekest man of his day. Didn't mean weak. Pharaoh didn't confuse him for a week when he stood before him and said, "Let my people go." Jesus Christ came meek and lowly, the Bible says in Luke chapter 11, 29. But listen, the money changers didn't confuse him for being a weak person when he took a whip and he drove them out. Meekness is not weakness. Meekness is strength under control. Meekness is gentleness. And again, if you're poor in spirit and you mourn it, you're going to be a gentle person. In fact, Galatians chapter 6, verse 1, you know that passage well. It says, "If a brother is overtaken in a fault, you who are spiritual, in the spirit of gentleness or meekness, go to them. Go to them and restore them." See, listen. If you're not poor in spirit, don't go to them. If you're not concerned about your own shortcomings, don't go to them. Don't try to fix somebody if you've got pride bouncing around in your heart. But if you understand your own poverty and it grieves you, and that has made you gentle towards others, you're the kind of person that needs to be out there helping others who have fallen along the way. That's a ministry you need to be doing. And again, it is a mark of spirituality. It is a mark of righteousness. Last part of that verse says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Doesn't seem that way, does it? When you look at the world, you think maybe Jesus sidestepped, doesn't it? Do the gentle really inherit the earth? I like what Haddon Robinson says, though, and it's just an observation. He said, you know, there is a way in which the meek do actually, in the end, survive when the strong fail. He said, if you look at the animal world, which mirrors the human world, he said, you would think that there would be more than enough bald eagles in the world. You would think that there would be far more eagles than there are sparrows. But the bald eagles have to be protected. They're the strong ones. The sparrows are the weak ones. But there are more sparrows than eagles. He said, you would think that the lambs would have to be on the endangered species list. Certainly not the lions and the tigers. There's millions of more lambs than there are tigers in the world. He said, you go to the oceans, and you would think that goldfish would be extinct by now. They're the meekest, most gentle fish in the sea. You would think that the whales would be overrunning it. There'd be far more whales than there are guppies. But we got to protect the whales. But the guppies are all over the place. He said, what you see in the world is oftentimes what you see among humans. There's the strong, there's the fierce, there's the fighters, there's the ferocious folks, and they tend to pass away. But there's a sense in which the meek who mind their own business, who have a gentleness about them, are able to have a contentment in life while everybody else is fighting for the thrones. They're able just to slide through life and enjoy it, find happiness. Jesus says, you want to talk about righteousness? You really want to talk about holiness? Let's talk about what it means to be poor in spirit. Let's talk about what it means to mourn your poverty. Let's talk about gentleness and meekness. Let's talk about strength under control. Amen. Will you stand with me?